This show was first broadcast on Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. For more information on our lineup of shows and the role we play in the media, visit freefm.org.nz.
Welcome to The Science Bug. I'm Morgan Marion.
And I'm Simon Connolly.
We're back with the second half of Simon's Natter with Renee Devenish. This time, we'll be hearing about what Renee's work might mean for the future and whether all those things were worth it in the end.
I am Renee Devenish. I recently completed my master's. It was ecology master's, and I focused on pollination, specifically insect pollinators and climate change.
So you're looking at the potential effects of increasing temperature, changes to the climate on metabolism of these different pollinator insects. How do you actually go about doing that in the lab?
Well, this was the fun part. The writing up is never the fun part of science. So because it was all mainly lab-based, you use what people call flow-through chambers. So it's either you can make them, or like I did, I just used something which was basically already pre-made. So people who study plants have this amazing piece of technology. It's from a company called Lycol. It's like a photosynthesis monitor, and it has what's called ergas in it, infrared gas analyzers. And what they do is they can tell changes in oxygen or carbon dioxide. And in that way, you can measure respiration or photosynthesis. So I didn't use it for photosynthesis because, fun fact, bugs don't photosynthesize.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, the things you learn.
Honestly, a fun fact for this bug podcast.
Yeah.
We all need to know that. But what they do is they respire.
Mm.
And so you can measure respiration. And respiration is directly related to metabolism in all organisms. So there is some fun maths you can use, another fun equation, more equations, which you can use to convert respiration, or the change in carbon dioxide gives you respiration. Because the more you respire, the more carbon dioxide you produce. So it's the same with insects. So you can measure respiration, convert it to metabolic rate. And there you have your metabolism that I need. The metabolism
just like magic. Data.
Just like that.
Yeah. So you were taking bees and flies and putting them in a little gas chamber? Is that what I'm hearing?
It was basically this fun long little tube. I shoved cotton wool in there because I discovered if you put cotton wool in there, something for them that's not this like smooth plastic, they sit in it and they actually calm down. Because what I wanted was resting metabolic rate. Because resting metabolic rate during flight and active metabolic rate, all different considerations that you need to take place, and it's all confusing within the metabolic theory of ecology, and I don't want to get into it. It was honestly mind-numbing. So I just wanted resting metabolic rate, and it was hard to get them to calm the hell down and just sit there. So I got shoved cotton wool in there. So I had a cozy little chamber, which then sealed off, so they're stuck in there. There's air flowing through it, and it measures the difference between the incoming air and the outgoing air.
Right, carbon dioxide. That's really clever.
Yeah. Yeah, so it pumps air through this little system, flow through. The air flows through the chamber. That's why it's called.
Makes sense.
Flow
makes
through.
Sense.
And then I took this whole chamber and I submerged it in a pool of water because it was very hard to change the air temperature of the air in there. And I tried a couple of different things. None of it was consistent enough or would change it quickly enough, except for what's called a water bath. So because water keeps it, like I said earlier, constant temperature. Pop the chamber in there, wait a couple minutes, and it becomes the temperature in there. And then you start respiration measurements. So yeah, I was basically torturing by bees by putting them in a chamber and submerging them in a little submersible.
Bees in submarines.
That's
really something.
Yeah.
And though the temperature changes to get at your kind of your research question, right? Of how they metabolize at different rates in these different conditions.
Basically, over a certain period of time, you get like an average respiration or metabolic rate. Not just so I'd measure for an hour, I'd measure respiration at one temperature. Or a bunch of different things, and I measured between 15 degrees Celsius and 35 degrees Celsius, which everyone asks, why? Why that temperature range, Renee?
Renee, why that temperature range?
Well, I'm really glad you asked, because I prepared an answer to this question. NIWA has some amazing data about past climate, and I went to look what are some of the highs and lows for summer. What might be temperatures bees might experience over summer? And I used that to make an average range. 35 is very high for New Zealand.
But not inconceivable.
With climate change, there are going to be more extremes.
Yay.
So what might it look like at these extremes?
Mm. Okay.
Yeah. So that's basically what I did.
Mm. That's really clever.
Yeah, it was quite fun.
Yeah. And what were the four species you were working on? Remind me.
So we had honeybees, Apis mellifera, Bombus terrestris, which is a bumblebee.
So that's two.
Yep. And then we have the one fly was a drone fly, Aristalis tenax, I believe. And now they're called drone flies, really interestingly, because they mimic drone bees, which are male bees. So they look like male bees.
Ah.
Even, this is a fun fact for anyone out there, there was this one, I can't remember which journal, but one of the journals had a special on bees. And on their cover was a drone fly.
Really? That was a scientific journal.
Yes, so funny. And people had to point out, that's actually a fly, not a bee. And
this Why is it that they do that?
So just to avoid predation.
Oh, because things think they're a bee and they would sting them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So they even fly like bees.
Hmm.
So flies fly, interestingly, their flight pattern, the way they fly is different to bees.
Hmm.
Except for drone flies, which fly like bees.
Would the differences be like things that people would have seen just looking at them out in their gardens and stuff?
Yeah. So the way bees fly is they don't really zoom from one place to another. They're more like a hovery type. So these flies are also called hoverflies.
Right.
Because they tend to fly in this hovery pattern. And people actually did study where they like videotaped and compared flight patterns and to see it matched bees. So yeah, this has actually been confirmed. But yeah, so that was the other one, and they exclusively pollinate. So they're one a fly species which doesn't do anything else but pollinate.
So they're a fly species that pretends to be a bee but actually does spend all its time pollinating.
Being a bee, yes. Yeah. Yes.
That's just commitment to the bit.
It is. They really want to be bees.
And your fourth species was?
Was the beautiful blowfly, which everyone sees all over the place in their kitchens, those glass bottle flies, they're really shiny. Lucia sericata, I think is their name.
And that would be a surprising one for a lot of people, because most people, and I certainly assumed, that they're just scavengers.
So what's really interesting is they need meat or carrion for their larval development.
To lay their eggs into.
Yeah. Larva eat the meat. But during the adult stage, they're generalists. They eat a lot of different things, including nectar. But what they do end up doing is because they feed on what I'm assuming is nectar, they pollinate. And there's was evidence in journals of them pollinating and
That's
being
really
pretty important pollinators.
So they'd be a very important pollinator species that a lot of people won't think about, really.
Yeah. And you wouldn't think about, you wouldn't be like, oh, just kill a fly. Mm. Doesn't matter. You know, it's good getting rid of them. Actually, they're quite important.
So you're taking these four different species, putting them in their little submarine,
yep.
Heating them between 15 and 35 degrees?
Yes.
Which of the four species was your favourite? Which was the best to work with?
The best was, and will always be my favourite, is the drone fly. They were so relaxed. First, they don't sting you,
mm-hmm.
and they don't try to sting you, and they can't sting you. So there's no like anxiety about moving them from one thing to another. They're so relaxed. You just pick them up, and they sit on your hand. They're like little pets. They're ridiculous. The worst is, I started with them, so I thought everyone else would be really easy as well. I was like, oh my god, this is the easiest thing I've ever done. You just pick them up, put them in the chamber, they sit there, they don't do anything, you take them out again, you have your data. They're fabulous. And the worst, if in case you were going to ask that question.
Well, I was going to ask because you said that one of the best things about drone flies is that they don't sting you.
Yes.
So I feel there's something else going on
there
here.
There is. And it would surprise you, it's the bumblebee.
Mm.
Bumblebees, very difficult. In multiple ways. First, they sting you.
Which a lot of people won't be aware of. Bumblebees have a very friendly reputation.
Yeah. I think. Basically, I would have to physically remove them from their nest box that I had and put them in this chamber. And the way they went for me is insane. I'll tell you a fun story. When handling bees, you use red light because they don't fly under red light. They don't see under red light. It's really funny. They will just stop flying and fall to the floor. So it's much easier to handle them. You can also put them in a fridge to cool them down and pick them up again. But that's not very useful for when you're trying to see what they do under temperature. Because then you have to wait longer for them to get to normal temperature and then up to the temperature you want them at. So this is just too much stress on their body anyway.
Mm.
So it would...
It would bias your data.
It would. So I couldn't cool them down. So I had to have them at normal activity levels. So then you go in there with a little jar, trap them, take them with the jar and put them in another container. And this process they do not like. Whatever you use, you can try to use soft tweezers, you can try to scoop them up. They will immediately... What they do is they lie on their back and they bite as well. Bumblebees. Honeybees don't. Bumblebees have, they lie on their back and do this interesting, I don't know what it's called, but it's like this curl position. Their stinger faces up and they start trying to bite, whatever this is. And they go for it. And they go so aggressively. Or they'll even fly in the red light. Just, even though they know they can't see, they'll just go for whatever they can. And what happened is they're at the little opening. It's this really small opening, about bee sized, obviously, that I put a container over. But I had, because fun fact, if you're only looking in red light, it's not actually that easy to see. And I had missed a gap. And the bee had miraculously, as it lifted off, found this gap and flew straight to my neck.
Oh my God.
And stung me in the neck like an assassin in the night. Awful. And then what had happened is I had to try and find this bumblebee. What people also don't know about bumblebees is they don't lose their stingers when they sting you. So they come back like wasps. And when they're angry, bumblebees are angry. But what's really hard is for them to calm down again once they're angry. Once they're protecting their hive, they go for it nonstop. And they bite and they sting. So it's mental trying to do stuff with them where you are bothering them.
Why do bumblebees want to kill themselves so badly?
I don't know. You're going to have to ask the bumblebees. But one thing is they freak out very easily. They don't necessarily attack you, but first, they can't seem to find sugar. I was trying to do a different experiment, which ended up not happening, because that is science. And things don't work, especially when you're trying to work with animals. Things don't always happen the way you want them to, which is very upsetting. But it's okay. We figured it out. But what happened is I wanted to do a flight cage experiment, which is basically this massive fake field of flowers. It has mesh around it, so they can't get out and forage on actual flowers. So what you do is you have to train them to realize there's food in this flight cage. So you have to take the food, which was called a sugar bladder, outside of, because they have a food source in there, outside of their hive. Put it at the front, and then over a couple of days, slowly move it away and away, slowly until they realize this whole thing is a source of, there's filthy food somewhere, so they'll go looking for it. I, first evening, removed it out so that they could learn where it was, gave them a couple hours, came back, half the hive was dead on the floor, because they just hadn't learned where it was. I don't know if I did something wrong, and we're going to have all these scientists saying, she was so stupid, she completely did this wrong. Maybe I did. That's part of learning. But yeah, then I was like, I need to buy these hives. They're like $100 or something more a hive. I don't have the research money to buy as they kill themselves. And then also, I didn't tell you, but what had happened is a couple killed themselves in the small chamber because it was small. So they freaked out to the point where they like freaked themselves out to death. They stressed themselves out to death.
Oh my God.
Especially at the higher temperatures.
Poor things.
I felt terrible.
So not only are they the bee that's most wanting to just get out there and sting you, they're also just starve themselves or just stress themselves out to death inside a little chamber.
They do.
That's crazy.
Yeah, don't choose bumblebees. Flies, great. More people need to appreciate flies. Flies are great. Love a good fly.
Mm-hmm. Especially a drone fly, apparently. Oh,
even better. You can literally go out in garden centers and catch them.
Mm.
I do that all the time.
And you were talking about, as well as the submerging bees into kind of different temperature, into like this little submersible chamber. As well as that experiment, you did behavioral experiments. What were those?
Oh yeah, so this was fun. So I wanted to look at, so we spoke about how as temperature changes, your energetic demands change if you're a cold-blooded animal. So I wanted to look at energy trade-offs between risk and foraging under different temperatures. So naturally, let's ignore temperature for a second. An animal, whether it's an insect, whether it's a deer, needs food. It's going to go out there and forage, but it also has predators. And it's going to have to decide, am I going to take time away from looking and trying to avoid predators to eat? Like what is the best case scenario? Or because it's a big fitness cost, because if you make the wrong decision, you get eaten and you die. Or you don't get food and you starve. So I want to see, can temperature affect this relationship? So I put them in little chambers again, had food. And then what I do is it's you kind of simulate predation by scaring them and seeing what their behavior is after being scared. And this was actually after all the failed things. This lovely scientist, Ashley Mortensen from Plot and Food, and I think David Pattermore as well, were able to help me come up with this new idea.
Mm. And what are you trying to get at with yours? You kind of mentioned it briefly there, but do you want to go into a little bit more detail?
Yeah. So basically the idea is if the insects are affected by temperature, their energetic demands are affected. And I wanted to see at different temperatures, do they make different foraging decisions? Are they going to be at high temperatures, going to avoid risks and go forage more, even though they think there's a predator around? Or are they going to kind of do the same? Does temperature actually have an effect? Because we want to see at high temperatures, are they going to be take more risks, which could mean more chances to die?
And why might they take more risks at high temperature?
Because their metabolism is high and they need more food. So that need for food just becomes such a big demand that they just ignore everything else.
Mm. So it links back to that the metabolic theory we were talking about before, where a higher temperature means they metabolize faster, means they need more food. And therefore, they might take more risks.
Yeah. So this was just a different angle of looking to see, can you predict from behavior and not how the temperature might affect them.
I mean, are there any other like cool things from your methods or any other like fun stories that you want to talk about before we get into anything else?
I think, like, lots of, when people think about ecology, they think about, like, going out in the field and doing things, and that is really fun. But to be honest, being able to manipulate things in a lab is great. And to be able to actually see how what you do changes behavior, you can often see it in person. It's just, animals are so fascinating. And being able to actually have that as, like, something you work with, it's really enjoyable.
How did the other people that were working in your lab find having live bees around? I remember distinctly there was a sign outside your door which said, like, warning, bees.
I had to have that there because, you know, people can get anaphylactic shock from bees. So that was just had to have it there. But actually everyone always loved to come and look at the bees. Everyone loved to come and see the bees. Everyone loved to tap the bumblebee box because once you tap it, they go, and they just all, it's like, I don't know, I suppose it's like a warning.
Yeah, they have this this like buzzing behavior where, yeah, it's literally a warning for predators to stay away. Mm.
It's actually just so fun to even just to watch people learn about them and experience them and see things that they would never see. You don't normally interact with a bumblebee hive.
Mm.
So to actually be able to look at it and see how they're crawling around and doing things, it was really fun. Although a couple of blowflies did escape my container. They're just blowflies. It's fine. But what happened is they were smaller than the holes I had for breathing, which I hadn't calculated properly. That was on me.
You were cutting like big air holes in for like if there was a dog sitting in the box or something.
What I had done is I reused the container I used for the drone flies.
Ah, right.
And drone flies were bigger than the blowflies.
Mm.
And I hadn't thought about that because there were flies. I wasn't too, like, worried about safety.
Yeah.
So what happened is they got around, and I get this call, and someone was like, Renee, your flies are all over the lab. Come here right now. Get rid of them. So funny how annoyed they were. There were two flies.
I think everyone that works with bugs has had that call at some point in their life.
Yeah, everyone's like, ew, bugs, get them out.
Hi there, this is Morgan. Just dropping in to confirm that I've once been at the conference and then had a call from a lab mate just to tell me that my stick insects had escaped and were on the ceiling. Now back to Simon.
You say people that really enjoyed coming to see the bees, did they enjoy coming to see the flies as much?
No, so sad. I did make people come and see the drone flies. They'd be like, oh, what's in there? I was like, drone flies, come look, they're so cool. And they'd be like, what is a drone fly? And then I'd have a massive spiel about how cool these flies are.
Which we've already had on this episode.
You're all welcome. Go look for drone flies. They're really fun.
So you did all these experiments looking at reactions to temperature and how this affects their behavior and their metabolism, ultimately trying to get at what might happen as a result of climate change to these four species. What was it that you found? What were some of your key takeaways?
All right, so I'll split it up so it's not confusing.
That's fine.
So for the metabolic experiments, what we found that it's the metabolic theory of ecology isn't universally applicable, which is
not unexpected.
And that it seems to only apply to certain insect pollinators. The interesting thing is you can still get species-specific scaling exponents, which is the number you can put into the equation to determine how metabolism is affected by temperature. So if you have the scaling exponent and you have temperature, you can calculate. But no one really does the calculations. It's just if you have this exponent, you can tell how sensitive a species is. So what I could see from my data was that bumblebees were the most sensitive. And looking at other literature, we know that bumblebees are often found in colder climates and don't necessarily do very well in high temperature areas where honeybees are actually quite tolerant to temperature. And they seem to do pretty well. Metabolism didn't change as dramatically with temperature. So from that, we could predict that honeybees will most likely be okay temperature-wise. They'll be able to handle the temperatures, but bumblebees won't. So you can kind of see which species. And then if you know what, this I didn't look at, but if you know what plants they pollinate, you can know which plants are going to be more, need more help. Or if it's a crop that you worry about, you can see if that crop might need artificial pollination in the future.
So you can potentially predict the knock-on effects of changing temperature based on these different insects.
What we also found was that body size does not scale like we expected it to.
What do you mean by that?
So we spoke about the 75% or 0%. So as body size increases, metabolism doesn't increase the way you would, the metabolic theory of ecology predicts. So again, the metabolic theory of ecology isn't perfect, cannot be applied broadly to all animals.
Mm. So you found that honeybees were quite resilient. Bumblebees, on the other hand, were much more sensitive.
Hmm.
So potentially, like you said, plants or crops that rely on bumblebees for pollination might be at more risk in the future as temperature increases around the globe.
Yeah, or you just get less pollination by them as they would potentially go. Because interestingly, bees can, to an extent, control the temperature of their hives.
Hmm.
Bumblebees have underground hives, so it's a bit more insulated. So they'll be more like, they might not go extinct, the numbers might not go down, but the amount of foraging they do would go down, so they'd spend more time in their hives.
That's quite relatable. You know, on those like hot extreme summers, everyone spends time inside where it's air conditioned, right?
Sometimes it's a bit difficult. This would be a very broad predictor because if there's honeybees and stuff, when it's hot temperature, they go drink more water, spend more time drinking, less time foraging. So that's something that's not taken into account by the metabolic theory of ecology.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so we talked about bumblebees and honeybees. What about your precious flies?
So interestingly, this general equation can't really be, drone flies doesn't really seem to match this, sit within this range that they predict. So, but they seem, flies generally seem pretty, both were generalist species and they both seem pretty tolerant of temperature. Mm-hmm. They weren't very sensitive.
Okay, either, so they're not ones to worry about in increasing temperatures?
No, you'd want to look potentially, thing is, like, it's so complicated, honestly. You'd want to...
Yeah, of course, this is a very kind of small, simple piece of a very large and complicated puzzle.
This is just pollinating during their adult life cycle. Mm. You'd probably also want to look at how the larval cycle might be affected by temperature, because they might have different sensitivities at those stages. So you could potentially look at what the ratios or the scaling is between temperature and metabolism for the different life cycles. Mm. And seeing that, you might find that maybe the larvae of flies are more sensitive to different species. So you can't... I don't want to make any broad statements.
Yes.
They will be sensitive. But it seems like the metabolic theory of ecology, I guess the main conclusion would be that you wouldn't be able to use it to make broad assumptions.
I guess it depends on what kind of assumption that you're making, right? So you can't definitively say that honeybees and the two flies that you talked about won't be affected by changing temperature, because there's all sorts of ways that it could. Yeah. It could affect, like you said, the distribution of the plants that they rely on or other factors in their behavior and their life cycle. Mm. But would it be fair to say that the evidence of an effect on bumblebees is probably the more concerning part of your... like results?
Yeah, what you would potentially see is that, yes, bumblebees are more sensitive to temperature. So perhaps it would show that they might be vulnerable. You could get ideas of vulnerability, I guess, which is often what we use to determine conservation efforts.
Mm.
What do we put our efforts into? So say someone might think, okay, we have to put more money and effort into bumblebees than we do flies because they're going to be fine. Why would, you know, it's not, you don't need to, there's limited money. Let's not waste money on stuff that seems to be okay.
Mm.
Yeah.
And what did you find with your behavior experiments on the foraging?
So that was quite fun, looking at the results of that. So we found that with high temperatures, they do increase their likelihood of foraging. So they're more likely to go and forage. High temperature, they're looking for more food. Seems like there's a high energy demand, so they need to go forage more. When there was a risk involved, when they thought there was a predator, they seemed to, interestingly, forage quicker. And I thought, oh, well, this is weird. You'd think they'd be more risk averse. But what I think it was is that they'd go to the food quicker to try avoid the predator in the surroundings, because the predator wasn't at the source of food.
Mm.
The predator I was simulating was around them. Basically, yes, they do change their behavior in presence of predators. And then when looking at temperature and risk together, we saw that when there's a perceived risk at high temperature, they do actually increase their likelihood of foraging. So despite there being a risk around, they are going to forage more often at high temperatures than they did at low temperatures, which could suggest, didn't look into it in detail, so I can't say for sure, but it would seem to suggest that because of temperature increasing metabolic rates, there's a higher energy demand. And they are changing the behavior in order to feed that high energy demand by going to feed, and that they seem to ignore risks around them and still go feed more at these high temperatures. So what this could potentially suggest is that during higher temperatures, as warming occurs out there in the wild and not in this experimental chamber, potentially they're going to be less risk averse, so they're going to be more likely to be predated upon, and they're going to be more likely to put themselves in risky situations because the demand for food is so much higher.
And is that across all four species, or is that just...
So yeah, that was across all four species.
That's incredible to get that kind of level of, like,
agreement across your
groups. That's pretty much all the time we have. I guess just any kind of final comments from you, any takeaways you want are, again, small but loyal listenership to have.
Right, yes. Flies are important. We should care about flies. Bees are not the only important ones. Honeybees are pretty tolerant as well. And we should remember, yes, save the bees. Bees are important. Love bees. But bees are taken care of by humans. There's a lot of stuff people can do to make sure they survive climate change by helping them out. Flies and some other animals out there need just as much help as bees, and they might even be at more risk to climate change.
All right. Renee Devenish, thank you for coming on the show.
Ah, thank you for having me.
I.B. Leave It. What a great interview. In our next episode, we'll have another awesome interview where I talk to Dr. Jenny Yant about ferocious bees and wasps. You've been listening to The Science Bug with Simon Connolly and Morgan Marion. You can find us at Science Bug Pod on Instagram and Twitter. This podcast is made possible by FreeFM, and you can find our previous episodes on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcasting app. Catch you next time!
Gulp, gulp.
We'll just put that at the end of the episode with no context. Just gulp, gulp.
For more episodes, use the accessmedia.nz app for iOS and Android devices, or subscribe to this podcast via Spotify, iHeartRadio, or Apple Podcasts. This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.